Well, David is now king of Judah. He's residing in Hebron. And 2 Samuel chapter 2 gives us a very brief accounting of David's coronation and all the circumstances are actually kind of odd in some ways, but it's informative. And a good question, I think, for us to ask is why would a single tribe opt for a king over simply having a tribal prince or a tribal leader like all the other ones do? In other words, it is customary that there is a designated head of the tribe, and then the tribes are further subdivided into clans, such that each clan would also have a leader who's under the authority of that tribal prince. Clan leaders would have less authority, not more, under a king. Having a king makes sense when the goal is to set a man over the top of a number of tribes, a man who is above the several tribal princes. But that's just not the case here. I don't have a definite answer for this problem, but a reasonable speculation is that the clan leaders of Judah figured that there would for sure be a new king over the northern tribal coalition that was headed by King Saul before his death, and that since Judah didn't want a northern king over them, it was better to anoint their own while there's still a power vacuum up to the north. I think this fits pretty well with the historical circumstances. The issue was a balance of power, and perhaps a hope that their man, David, might even become king over all the tribes, thus giving Judah a position of preeminence over all the other tribes. So let's reread most of 2 Samuel chapter 2 this evening to set the stage for this evening's lesson. 2 Samuel chapter 2, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 335. We'll start reading in verse 4. Verse 4. After this, starting with verse 1. Verse 4. Then the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they informed David that the men of Yabesh Gilead were the ones who had buried Saul. So David sent messengers to the men of Yabesh Gilead with this message: "May you be blessed by Adonai, because you showed this kindness to your lord, Shaul, Saul, and you buried him. Now may Adonai show his kindness and truth to you. I too will show you favor because you have done this. Be strong and be brave. Saul, your lord, is dead, but the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim and made him king over Gilead, the Ashuri, Jezreel, Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel. Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, was 40 years old when he began to rule over Israel, and he ruled for 2 years. But the house of Judah, it followed David. David was king in Hebron, over the house of Judah for 7 years and 6 months. Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And while Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and David's servants also went out, and they met together by the pool at Gibeon. And one group sat down on one side of the pool, the other on the other side. And Abner said to Joab, "If it's all right with you, let's have the young men get up and fight it out between themselves while we watch." And Joab said, "Yes, let them." So they got up and paired off, 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of David's servants. And each one grabbed his partner by the head, and he drove his sword into his side so that they fell down together. For this reason, that place was named Helkat Hatzurim, Field of Blades, and it is in Gibeon. Now, the battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten by David's servants. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. And Asahel was as fleet-footed as a gazelle in an open field, and Asahel chased Abner, going straight for him, veering neither right nor left. And Abner looked behind him and asked, "Is that you, Asahel?" "Yes, it is," he answered. And Abner said to him, "Well, turn off to your right or your left. Catch one of the young men. Take his armor." But Asahel wouldn't turn aside and kept following. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside and stop following me. Why should I kill you? If I did, how could I look at your brother Joab in the eye?" But he still refused to turn aside. So Abner stabbed him in the groin with the back end of the spear, so that the shaft protruded behind him. He fell down and died on the spot. Everyone who came to the place where Asahel lay dead stopped there. Joab and Abishai continued in pursuit of Abner, and the sun went down when they arrived at Amah Hill, across from Giach, along the Gibbon Desert Road. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together into a phalanx behind Abner and stood on top of the hill. And then Abner called out to Joab, "Must the sword go on devouring forever? Don't you know that in the end it can only produce bitterness? How long will it be then before you tell the people to quit pursuing their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you hadn't said something, there's no doubt that the people would have kept following their brothers all night long." And then Joab sounded the shofar, and with that the people halted. They stopped pursuing Israel, and they stopped fighting. Abner and his men went through the Arabah all that night. They crossed the Jordan, went through all of Bitron, and arrived at Mahanaim. Joab returned from following Abner. From there, when he brought the troops together for review, 19 of David's servants were missing along with Asahel. But David's servants had killed 360 of Abner's men of Benjamin. They took Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb in Beit Lechem. Then Joab and his men marched all night so that they reached Hebron at daybreak. Now we're going to run into a lot of political intrigue over the next several chapters. So if you find that kind of thing interesting, you're going to just love this study for the next few weeks. The men of Judah who appointed David as king also inform him about the men of Jabesh-Gilead, city of Jabesh-Gilead, who displayed such great courage by braving the presence of the Philistines to retrieve the decapitated body of King Saul from the walls of Beit Shan, and then to give him a proper burial at their own city on the east side of the Jordan River. So here we see one of the qualities of David that made him so dear to the Lord. It was usual and customary for a new king to purge his predecessor's accomplishments, his family, and everybody who sympathized with the former king. But instead, David reached out to the people of Jabesh-Gilead and even sought to reward them for their faithfulness to King Saul. Now recall that the people of Jabesh were not only politically aligned with Saul, but also they were closely related to him by blood, which is the foundational reason for their alliance with him in the first place. David sent messengers to the leaders of Jabesh, and he said that because they had shown such kindness to Saul, that not only does he ask Jehovah to show them kindness, but that he, David, wishes to demonstrate kindness to them. Now, the multiple use of the word kindness is in the original Hebrew language, chesed, and it indicates the commission of a righteous deed that's beyond everyday kindness. It's an act of mercy, it's an act of grace that mimics the kindness of God. But there's also present a very complicated Middle Eastern thought pattern and dialogue that's difficult for modern Westerners to spot. See, the underlying implication is that when we read of a person wishing chesed, onto another. It's because the other's own chesed, because of the other's own chesed, and it's because the person who is at the receiving end of this righteous deed is unable to repay it himself. So in this case, the citizens of Jabesh Gilead had showed chesed, kindness, to Saul and to his family, but since Saul is dead, he obviously can't reciprocate with a righteous deed towards the citizens of Jabesh. And such a thing is quite intolerable to Middle Eastern sensibilities, and it has to be remedied somehow. We see this same concept in the book of Ruth, between Naomi and Ruth and Orpah. And in Ruth chapter 1, we read this. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Each of you go back to your mother's house. May Adonai show grace," in Hebrew, chesed, "to you, as you did to those who died and to me. May Adonai grant you security in the home of a new husband." And then she kissed them and they began weeping aloud. So here, Naomi is telling Ruth and Orpah that even though they did chesed towards her, that is, in being good wives to her two sons and good daughters-in-law to her, she's not in a position to reciprocate, as is expected, so she prays that the Lord will be the one to repay them. And then once they are provided with new husbands, which is a divine act of chesed, then the new husbands will also help to repay. So this idea of repaying good deed for good deed is very Middle Eastern. So since the deceased Saul and the people of Jabesh can no longer show loyalty and chesed one to the other, David suggests, in addition to God giving chesed to the people of Jabesh, that he would be the one who repays the people of Jabesh for their act of righteous kindness, their chesed towards Saul, and that he's also offering a bond of faith with them in place of the bond that they had with Saul. Well, in verse 7, David exhorts them into accepting this offer by saying, "Be strong and be brave." Well, what would strengthen bravery have to do with Jabesh, city of Jabesh, accepting David's offer of repayment and kindness? Essentially, it is because this repayment and kindness is all wrapped up in Jabesh establishing a covenant with David. David is asking Jabesh to break away from the northern tribal coalition and instead to become part of David's southern kingdom. David is asking that this group of men with such close ties to the tribe of Benjamin, which was King Saul's tribe, to transfer their loyalty to the tribe of Judah. David is suggesting that instead of Jabesh continuing on with their alliance under the house of Saul, they switch. They become allied with David. This indeed is going to take courage, because their northern tribal coalition partners will not only be supremely unhappy with them for doing that, they might even try to punish them for what they would likely see as no less than treason. Jabesh's response to David's offer isn't given. And considering what happened to Jabesh Gilead several decades early, when the mostly northern tribes of Israel punished them severely, actually nearly drove them into extinction, their reluctance to jump at David's offer can be understood. Well, verse 8 now offers us a change of scenery. Okay, we move now from David's southern headquarters in Hebron to the offices of the government of the northern tribal coalition, the kingdom of Saul. Abner. He was Saul's top military commander. He was also either Saul's uncle or his first cousin. Traditions kind of differ on what exactly that relationship was. And the situation was that the north had lost their king, King Saul. And there was only one son of Saul that remained alive to continue on with Saul's dynasty, Ish-bosheth. Now, without doubt, Abner was the real power in Saul's kingdom at the moment, simply because he had the might of his army behind him. And since Ish-bosheth is a legitimate heir to the throne, Abner has little choice but to appoint him as the new king, or it's Saul's dynastic replacement. Now, Ish-bosheth is not so much a name as an epithet. It's unthinkable that a man would name his son Man of Shame. And that's what Ish-bosheth means. So there is some disagreement over what his real given name actually was. Later in the book of Kings, we see mention of this same fellow, but he is given the name of Eshbal. And there's good reason to think that this may indeed have been his original given name. This name, Ishiel, may seem trivial to you on the surface, but there's good reason to spend a little time with it, because this helps us to understand the ancient Hebrew mindset at this point in Israel's cultural development. Understanding these sorts of nuances, you see, is one of the many keys that unlocks a lot of mysteries and difficulties in the Bible. Eshbal means fire of Baal. It's a name that speaks of strength. At least it does if one's a pagan. But would a Hebrew king like Saul assign a pagan name to his own son? Here's the answer. In reality, Baal carried a dual and actually a triple meaning at this time in history. Baal meant Lord. Lord, as in the sense of master. At least it did from a generic standpoint, and it was used in reference to a person. But it was also a term that was regularly used in reference to spiritual beings. And when it was, it meant God, little g, God. Thus we will see biblical reference to the Baalim, that is the Baals, the gods, plural, many different gods. But of course, Baal was also the name, or better, the title that was given to the Canaanites' chief god, or at least to the chief male god, because his wife was Ashtoreth, and that depended on which Canaanite tribe or nation, which Canaanite nation one belonged to. Now, this structure is actually very parallel to a more modern-day use of the English word lord. Lord can merely mean a term of royalty. It can refer to someone who has authority. Lord can also be referring to God in a general sense, and Christianity especially will refer to God on a more personal basis as who? The Lord. So we use that word in a lot of different ways. By the time of David, the Hebrews had borrowed the word Baal, and they had added it to their own vocabulary. And they used it to mean Lord in the sense of a person with authority. Thus, both in the Bible and in other ancient Jewish sources, we will find Hebrew names that actually incorporate the word Baal. It doesn't necessarily mean a loyalty or a dedication to the pagan god Baal, but at times it did. But it did reflect a very casual, a very unpious attitude towards the law of Moses and to the Hebrew religion. But that's what happens to language. A word that means one thing is incorporated into a new language, and it comes to mean something similar, but not quite the same. And after a generation or two since the word's adopted, the use of it is done without even thinking about it. No one bothers to challenge its real meaning or whether it's even being used properly. There is no reference, no reference to Saul turning his loyalty over to a pagan god. So very likely the name of his son, Eshbal, was just meant to be regal in nature. Fire of the Lord, meaning a human Lord. However, in later times, there grew to be a great sensitivity among the religious Jews to the name or word Baal, one can imagine. So the editors of some of the Old Testament books determined it was inappropriate for that word, Baal, to appear in the holy text, and therefore they wouldn't write it. Of course, they wouldn't say the word Baal because it was offensive to them. Thus, when they copied the most ancient biblical scrolls, they substituted the word Bosheth, which means shame, when they ran across the word Baal. Thus, Esh Baal became Ish Bosheth. This idea of future scribes and editors adhering to a kind of, I don't know, religious political correctness of their time that caused them to substitute one word that they now thought was offensive for another that was now religiously and politically acceptable is especially noteworthy when it comes to God's formal name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which I have elected to pronounce Yehovah, others have elected to pronounce Yahweh. And the word YHWH, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, also became a very sensitive issue to the Jewish people around the 4th century BC. And while the word was retained in written form and their new handwritten copies of the Bible, in the margins of the scrolls, a handful of other words, such as Adonai, meaning Lord, or Hashem, meaning the name, or Elohim, meaning God, were written in, so that as the scroll would be read out loud, these words would be used in place of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now see, these sorts of variations in biblical names and places and these substitutions of words from one scroll or manuscript to the next, oh, it's created all kinds of difficulties and controversies in Bible translations. But most of the time, if we'll read what the ancient Hebrew sages say about it, then we'll find out the reason for these changes, even if the reasons for it are kind of dubious. Well, let's move on. For some reason, Abner decided to relocate Saul's son, Ish-Bosheth, out of the northern region of Canaan and then across the Jordan River to a place called Mahanaim. And it was there that he formally appointed Ish-Bosheth to be his father's successor, the new king of Israel. Now, there's a couple of interesting aspects to what's happening here. One is to ask why it is that Abner would move Ish-Bosheth to the other side of the river just to appoint him king. The reason is it would be a lot easier for Ish-Bosheth to set up his new government there because the Philistines at the time had way too much control over the land that constituted Saul's old kingdom. A second issue is, why would Abner want to crown Ish-Bosheth at all, since apparently he knew that David was to be the king? He knew this. It's clear that Abner had more respect for Yehovah and for his commandments and for his decrees than did his former boss, King Saul. The ancient sages and rabbis have some very interesting takes on this issue, of just what was in Abner's mind that caused him to go ahead and make Ish-Bosheth the new king despite his own admission, by the way, that we're going to read in chapter 3, that he was well aware. He knew that David was God's choice to be king over all the Israelite tribes. Well, the Jewish commentary called Bereshit Rabbah states that Abner did not deny that David was to be king, but he only thought it wasn't yet the appointed time. This conviction had to do with a tradition that had evolved that the tribe of Benjamin was to supply at least two kings before David would then become the anointed king. And this belief was due to a statement made in the Torah in Genesis 35, 11, that God blessed Jacob as he was returning from Mesopotamia, and he was fleeing from his uncle Laban, by saying that kings shall issue from your loins. This was taken to mean that since up to now there was no indication that any king had come from the sons already born to Jacob, that these kings would be manifested in a not yet born son of Jacob. And tradition says that the only son not yet born to Jacob was Benjamin. Therefore, it was Benjamin that would produce kings. And since the word's plural, it means at least two Benjamite kings had a rule before David would assume the throne. Therefore, reasons the rabbis, Abner was just being righteous by insisting that the second Benjamite king be installed. That second king would be Ishbosheth, Saul's son. And then only after would Abner help David become king. So their position is Abner was determined to fulfill the prophetic words of Genesis 35:11. Now, I am, frankly, a little bit skeptical of that rabbinical reasoning. Not only does it seem that such logic is less than clear, it also appears to me that there is better, more straightforward answers present in the scriptures. Abner, you see, was now the real and undisputed power in the north. Ishbosheth was too young and incompetent to lead Israel on his own. Abner knew that by installing this weak and easily manipulated Ishbosheth as his puppet, that he would personally control Israel using Saul's sole surviving son as just a proxy. And at the same time appear to be doing the right thing in the people's eyes by continuing Saul's dynasty with his only surviving son. At best, Abner was manipulating the situation so that when David finally did assume the throne over Israel, David would be forced into giving Abner a position of high status in his kingdom. At worst, Abner knew that God intended to make David king, but he hoped that under the right circumstances, Abner could postpone David's coronation indefinitely for his own benefit. Well, verse 9 explains that Ishbosheth was made king over Gilead, the Asherites, Jezreel, Ephraim, Benjamin, and then all of Israel. Now, Gilead was generally the tribes of Gad and Reuben located over in the Transjordan, east side of the Jordan River. The Asherites are seen as a copyist error and probably ought to read the Geshurites, and that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Gesher lay beyond the northern boundary of Manasseh, on the east bank of the Sea of Galilee. Now, we've seen a mention of the Geshurites in earlier stories. And later we'll read of David marrying a Geshurite woman and having a son with her. For whatever reason, a political alliance with Gesher was deemed important for David. The Jezreel is referring to the western slope of the Gilboa Mountains, which lies in Issachar's territory. Ephraim represents the heartland of Canaan. And the designation in this case tends to include that part of Manessa that lies on the west bank of the Jordan. The idea is that it is the territory set aside for the house of Joseph, through which his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, would occupy it. Benjamin is kind of a buffer territory. It's kind of sandwiched, like the meat in a sandwich, in between the north and the south of Canaan. So the term all Israel in this context means the northern tribes. It does not include the southern tribes. Now, why this strange kind of description that gives specific territories, but then just ends with this inclusive term, all Israel? Why not just say all Israel to begin with? Because this was a progression. Abner's strategy was to move Ish-bosheth to an area where he could operate in freely, without Philistine influence and outside of any of Judah's, and therefore of David's, territorial claims. So he chose Mahanaim in Gilead as that base of operation. So step by step, he would rebuild the northern coalition of tribes that Saul had constructed, but then fell apart after his death, until Ish-bosheth would finally be accepted as king by all the Israelite tribes of the north. That was the plan. Thus, it was that Ish-bosheth would only gradually be able to put together a kingdom, but it was going to begin with Gilead. Next in his sights would be Gesher, then Jezreel, then Ephraim, then Manasseh, and then Benjamin. That would complete this rebuilt coalition. Now, of course, we see that David must have figured out Abner's plan, so he had invited those leaders of the key city of Jabesh, which was located in Gilead, to be David's allies in hopes of derailing Abner's plans for Ish-bosheth. Well, verses 10 and 11 work together. And they explain that Ish-bosheth only reigned for 2 years over Israel, meaning those northern tribes. But David reigned 7.5 years over Judah. Now, this presents an interesting chronology problem. I'm only going to spend a moment on it, but if I don't, somebody's going to ask me about it later. We know that David was appointed king of Judah at about the same time that Abner appointed Ish-bosheth to be Saul's successor. And as we're going to find out in the next chapter, Ish-bosheth lost his kingdom to David. So how do we account for the 5.5 years of time difference? It seems logical that David and Ish-bosheth's respective reigns should have been parallel, very nearly the same amount of time. Well, in a nutshell, the general consensus of rabbis and scholars is this. Notice that verse 10 says that Ish-bosheth reigned over what? Israel for 2 years. Israel, at this time, is what the Bible calls that confederation of northern tribes that operates under one king. We talked earlier how it was Abner's strategy that Ish-bosheth would rebuild that coalition step by step, tribe by tribe, until he had put the kingdom back together, and thus reign over all Israel. Therefore, it took Ish-bosheth 5.5 years to gain all those territorial loyalties back, and only then could it be said that he ruled over Israel. Once that happened, he was only on the throne for 2 more years. Until David took over the northern kingdom. Well, in verse 12, a chance meeting between men loyal to Ish-bosheth, men loyal to David occurred, and the result was going to be war. It seems that Abner had business in his family hometown of Gibeon, that's in the territory of Benjamin, and he and his contingent of men stopped to refresh themselves at a watering hole called the Pool of Gibeon. And since Judah's territory abutted this same place, Joab, a nephew of David and his current commanding military officer and some of his brothers and some other men also just happened to arrive at this water pool at the same time for the same reason. Imagine their surprise. Okay, guys, what do we do now? Should they engage in battle? Should one or the other withdraw? And Abner, apparently kind of impulsively, proposed that each side choose 12 of their men, then they fight gladiator style in a representative battle. The idea is much like what happened with David and Goliath. Rather than the full armies of these two enemies fighting one another, each side would only send out their champion. And then those two men would fight, and the losing side would consider it a defeat of their entire army, and they would leave the battlefield, and that would save massive bloodshed. Well, the pool of Gibeon has been located. Turns out it was a man-made pool. It was a large cistern carved out of rock. It was about 40 feet in diameter, almost 80 feet deep. It caught the runoff from the surrounding area. It was all rocky, and it stored the water. There's even a stairway carved into the walls of the cistern, so that as the water level dropped, talking 80 feet here, the precious liquid could still be accessed right down to the bottom. The 12 pairs of fighting men eventually erupted into the other troops from both sides getting into the act, battling. The narrative seems to indicate that the reason this turned into a full-scale battle was because there wasn't a decisive outcome from the representative warfare between the two pairs of 12 men. Rather, it seems, it was a draw. They all killed each other. It turns out that Joab was there with two of his brothers, Abishai and Asahel. And it appears that as Abishai was the oldest, then Joab must have been the middle child. These were David's nephews. They were sons of David's sister, Zeruiah. David's men got the best of Abner's men, and so Abner and his company of soldiers now fled to save their lives. Zeruiah's three sons gave chase, but the youngest, Asahel, he was a much faster runner than his brothers. And the narrative describes him as being as swift as a gazelle or a deer. Well, the youthful and unfortunately foolhardy, Asahel set his sights on the big prize, the big kahuna. He was going to go after Abner, the commander. Not giving it a thought that this grizzled old warrior had managed to live so long because he was a fierce and cunning fighter who just didn't know how to lose. And as Asahel got closer and closer in this foot race with the aging Abner looking over his shoulder, he tells the boy, maybe you need to rethink your intentions, young man. And the supremely confident Abner suggested, maybe it wasn't such a good idea that he should catch him, because Abner could easily kill him. And this would cause even more bad blood between the military commanders of the opposing kingdoms, Joab and Abner. But in youthful exuberance, Asahel responded by turning on the jets. Well, now he's breathing down Abner's neck. So Abner used an old military trick that only the most experienced would dare to try. Abner had sharpened the wooden handle end of his spear. And as Asahel got within inches and was ready to strike, certain he was about to end the life of this old man of legendary status, Abner unexpectedly and abruptly stopped. And without turning, he just thrust the sharpened handle of his spear backward. And Asahel literally ran into it and impaled himself upon it. Because Asahel had raced out ahead of everyone, it took some time before the rest of the group caught up with him. And when they did, everybody froze in their tracks because they came upon Asahel's lifeless body. The sight of their dead brother caused the adrenaline to flow now, and it gave them a second wind. And Abishai and Joab, they sped off in pursuit of Abner with blood in their eyes and murder in their hearts, and they caught up with Abner at a place called Amah Hill. No one knows where that is. But by then, Abner's Benjamite troops had amassed around him. They'd all taken up defensive positions. And as Abner saw Joab and his men approach, he yells out to them, "Wasn't going to serve either side. You just continue this bloodshed." What Abner's words were about was trying to convince Abishai and Joab to put aside what was now a personal vendetta against Abner. This wasn't any longer about military victory. After all, there wasn't any real need for a battle to have started in the first place. Since all David and Ishbosheth were doing was just keeping their own territories, there was no war going on here. So Joab responds in verse 27, by saying, "As God lives, if you hadn't said something, there's no doubt that the people would have kept following your brothers all night long." The meaning of his words is that it was Abner who had instigated this. If Abner hadn't rashly suggested that these 12 representatives from each side fight each other, then all these soldiers wouldn't have died. Azael would still be alive. Abner's responsible for it all in Joab's eyes, especially for his younger brother's death. And the dynamics of the entire situation have now changed. What before the incident at the Pool of Gibeon was a cold war of sorts between those loyal to David and those loyal to Ishbosheth, this had now turned into a family blood feud. Abner knew that this is what would happen. And this is why he asked Asahel to turn aside, go after somebody else. This is really going to be a big mess. We get into it. Abner knew he was going to have to kill Asahel. And the result would be this ongoing series of revenge killings now between the two families. In any case, Joab knew that there had been enough bloodshed for one day, and that Abner and his men were up there in strong defensive positions, so he blew the shofar as a signal to end the fighting. And Abner followed through, and he led his men on the trail north through the Arabah back into his home territory. The Arabah is this long rift valley that begins at the Sea of Galilee, extends all the way south to the Red Sea, to the Gulf of Aqaba. Well, when both sides arrived home, they counted their dead. The victory for David's men was overwhelming. They only lost 20 men, including Asahel. But Abner, they had lost 360. Now, in some ways, this is to be expected. David's men, remember, were experienced and apt fighters. They had followed David for several years. They were well-trained. These men were part of that 600. Who'd been with David through so much over the last few years. But as Asahel's brothers carried his body to the family burial plot in Bethlehem, Joab just burned with desire for revenge. The truce arranged at Amah Hill between he and Abner applied only to kingdom business. But the matter over his brother Asahel's death was personal. This was personal. This was between him and Abner. This was, after all, the Middle East. All blood feuds end badly. We're going to start chapter 2 next week. Please write.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.